really powerful influence in your life, labels. I'm betting you may not be consciously aware of even a fraction of your labels or the power of those labels, whether they come from the outside world or from within you yourself. Your labels are so important because they are at the core of your fictional self. They are one of the ways in which the world has attacked your authenticity and messaged you on what is expected of you if you are to be a good sheep. Maybe your most self-changing and limiting labels came from your parents. Maybe they came from a cruel peer group or from teachers or coaches. Maybe they came from within you when you observed yourself messing up in life. Either way, whatever the source, you must acknowledge the existence of the labels, challenge the fit, and confront the impact these labels have had on your concept of self. Recall the question that I asked near the beginning of this audiobook. Who are you? As we saw, many people answer that question in terms of their jobs or their function. When you ask them, who are you? They say, I'm a loan officer. I'm a plumber. I'm a telemarketer. I'm a mom. I'm a professor. I'm a real estate agent. But there's a second, very important way that people answer that question, one they may never actually put into words. By that I mean, no matter how you answer the question aloud, I'm a businesswoman, I'm a paralegal, internally, you may be answering it very differently. Without a doubt, you have a set of social mask labels that you retreat to when meeting someone or presenting yourself to the world. You also have a set of internal labels that you apply to yourself as a function of the judgments you place on yourself. Judgments that you would never disclose orally, but yet they are a key part of your personal truth. Internally, your answer to the question then is comprised of a separate set of labels, a set that can be incredibly unkind and scathing. Put simply, a label happens first when you allow someone else to define you based on how they perceive you, and second, when you judge yourself and crystallize that judgment as a lasting self-characterization. Labels are the icons of the self-talk or the internal dialogue you began as a child and continue to this very day. They may reflect the conclusions you reached when you measured yourself by some yardstick imposed on you by the world. Maybe the measure was popularity, and you weren't, so your label was uncool or nerd. Maybe it was money, and since you had none, the label was loser. Maybe it was grades, and your brother or sister made better ones, so you were labeled not the best student. Unlike most of the other words you use, a label has an emotional charge. In short, it's not just descriptive, it's accusatory, and it can sting. It is this emotional aspect that gives the label its devastating power. If you were to look up label in the dictionary, you'd find it defined as a term of classification. A label places us within a certain group of other people who supposedly are similar to us. That same label may also say that you are excluded from certain other groups of people. Everyone within a classification described by a label supposedly behaves in a certain way. Everyone outside it behaves differently. When you think about what that means, you recognize that a label is kind of a prediction. Because you're a Sagittarius, you're going to do X in a certain situation. She's a Scorpio, so she'll do Y instead. You hear even smart people indulging in this kind of voodoo in order to reduce other people and themselves to a predictable set of boundaries. High school in particular tends to be a fertile breeding ground for our impulse to classify. There are the cool and the uncool, the jocks, the nerds, the beauty queen, granolas, freaks, dopers, and so on. These years are an acutely vulnerable time of life when we are especially sensitive to social relations, and we're hungry to know where we fit in. Our emotional sensitivity means that the labels we assume in high school may penetrate deeply into our self-concept. Expectations about our classmates and ourselves may harden to the point that not living to one's label becomes unthinkable. We develop some very firm ideas about how other people should be or shouldn't be. We don't want the dumb jock football player to make straight A's because that violates our desire for predictability. It's not right when the pencil neck geek masters the guitar and becomes Buddy Holly. He was supposed to stay a geek. More importantly, we may become convinced ourselves that the prediction associated with the label that has been placed on us is the real thing, ironclad. We may become so adapted to our own label that we see any challenge to it as futile and even a threat. As you get ready to identify the labels that may be at work in your own life, please understand that not all harmful labeling is motivated by hatred or by a desire for control over other people. There's a term, iatrogenic, that describes harm induced by a healer. Iatrogenic injury results from good intentions. For example, a doctor prescribes a couple of extra weeks bed rest and the patient develops bed sores. Or the patient loses some mental function, not because of his or her illness, but because the doctor cautioned that there might be some loss of mental function. Similarly, iatrogenic labeling is destructive labeling that is actually motivated by kindness. A label that was intended to be helpful proves to be a lifelong disaster. Just because one has good intentions doesn't mean that the label can't be harmful. Parents of handicapped children, for example, will sometimes communicate to their children that they lack the capacity to deal with the normal world. Understandably, the parents fear that their children will be bullied or hurt in that world. However, this desire to protect a child may give rise to an adult who is more handicapped by his or her self-concepts of weakness and fear than by their actual physical handicaps. So you need to be alert to the possible effects of iatrogenic labeling in your own life. Look for any label that may have diminished your sense of self, boxing you into a lifelong sense of self-limitations, whether or not the labeling was done in a loving and protective way. And let me quickly add that this is not an invitation to snarl at your parents for your sense of powerlessness. Yes, parents, teachers, and other authority figures may have assigned you some iatrogenic labels, but you have the responsibility for yourself now. Your task is to look inside, find those labels, and decide for yourself whether you want to continue using them or not. It's your choice. Some people react to labels with complete and total conformance to the implied message, and other times they radically react against the label by becoming extreme in rebelling in the opposite direction. Perhaps a person that has been put down and labeled inferior might respond with arrogance and a false sense of superiority. They may pretend vehemently that they couldn't care less about the acceptance that has been withheld from them. It's important to note that in both cases, whether you are conforming to a label or radically rebelling against it, the label is controlling and dictating your life, and that is a bad thing. Living to a label can only become part of your personal truth and concept of self if at some level it's working for you. Living to that label, giving your power away, must provide some kind of income, social, spiritual, economic, or otherwise, that can make even the most painful and inappropriate labels highly durable and stubbornly resistant to change. Somehow, some way, accepting the definition of that label provides you some currency, or you simply wouldn't do it. Maybe it's an excuse to be passive or angry or play the victim. But whatever it is, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't live to that label without a reward, however sick that payoff might be. I have encountered countless ordinary people who labeled themselves as patients not because they were sick or deformed, but because they received huge payoffs by living to that label. Calling themselves patients gave them an identity. Whether their disorders were real or imagined, whether they had legitimate disorders or were total hypochondriacs, it was a badge of how they wanted to be treated and how they wanted to treat themselves, giving definition to what they should or should not do. Their implied message was, I'm a patient, so respect the label rather than me. I'm weak and limited in what I can do for myself or others. Feel pity for me and give me respect, but don't you dare expect anything from me. For many people, labels such as patient or student gives them the payoff of having a socially sanctioned timeout from the performance demands of the world. How could anyone expect someone to get up and go to work if, after all, that person is sick and participating in some program of treatment? Very convenient if you're just plain lazy, don't you think? Problem is, once again, it's totally fictional, and living to that label completely ignores the authentic self and all the skills and abilities that are buried there. There is another obvious problem with labels. They are almost always backward-looking. Labels describe where you perceive you have been, not where you are. If you give in to them, however, they can sure predict where you're going. The focus of your accumulated labels is to look back rather than ahead. To focus on your accumulated labels is to allow your past to become your future. What's true for the other internal factors is also true for labels. You distort information to support your labels. If you decide that your child is a hellion, that your boss is a jerk, or that you are a loser, you will be sensitized to and will eagerly collect every kind of information that supports those labels and rejects any contrary data. You'll do the same thing whether the label is applied to someone else or it's applied to you. I guarantee that if you have bought into a bunch of labels, your radar will scan around and find support for them. You will live to the label. If you're like most people, you will shut the data processing window and you will live that label. Why? Because again, if you're like most people, you would rather be right than happy, and your payoff, however illogical, is likely very, very powerful. It's time for some self-diagnosis. How do you label yourself? Did someone tell you that you were a loser? Have you in turn labeled yourself a loser? Somewhere along the way, did you accept a label in order to be accepted by a group? Have you labeled your life a dead end? If you have, what does that do for your life? To pull yourself free from your fictional self, you've got to get your hands around the labels that may have entrapped you. Evaluate them and delete them. The following exercises will help you do just that. Exercise number one. Simply list on a piece of paper all the labels you have been given. Starting as far back in your life as you can remember, write down every label you can recall. Your list will include some labels that you know had an influence on your self-concept, and it will include some that you believe you have rejected. Exercise 2. After you have listed all the labels you remember for exercise 1, go back to your list and underline the ones that you believe were put on you by your parents. Circle the ones that you believe were put on you by people other than your parents. Try to remember the first time you felt the sting of these labels and what you were doing at the time. Put a check beside any labels that you can sense to be a part of your life today. Are you operating on the belief that these labels are true today and still reflect you? Exercise 3. It's time now for you to remember which labels on your list have become part of your own labeling. Since our internal labeling often lies beneath our consciousness, this exercise demands your utmost concentration and focus. What you're going to list are the labels that you took away from some event as your conclusion about yourself. For each self-label, try to remember those times that you knew that you identified with your label. In other words, when you accepted the label as a true statement about yourself. What was the situation? Finally, imagine that your self-labels are listed on your resume. Now suppose you're looking at that resume the way a future employer might. Is he or she saying anything like the following? Let's see, who do we have here? Okay, a fat, lazy drone, a worker bee with no ambition. That's super. Let's hire a whole bunch of those. Absurd, isn't it? If those are not the labels you would want an employer to attach to you, then why do it yourself? Resolve that you will no longer conspire with the world in assigning limiting labels to yourself. Whatever the payoff you're getting from living to your labels, determine that you are going to move out of that comfort zone once and for all. In continuing to take stock of your own self-talk, you may become aware that there is a certain species of that talk that is unlike any other. It's a self-conversation, but it has this distinction. While you may have the sense that it is filled with sour notes from your past, it seems to happen so fast that it's just kind of a blur. Unlike the rest of your internal dialogue, which takes place in real time and can be listened to at will, this embedded mental activity is tough to get a handle on. It happens incredibly fast, and it is especially malignant. For those reasons alone, it demands a separate discussion and your special attention. This especially dangerous kind of self-talk is what I call a tape. A tape is negative self-talk that you have rehearsed and repeated for so long and so often that it has become overlearned. It has played in your head hour after hour, day after day, month after month, year after year. Ultimately, it became so deeply ingrained that it becomes an automatic response. It can be unleashed without your even being aware that something has happened in your life to trigger it. I call these tapes because I grew up in an era when big mainframe computers were run by huge magnetic tapes that told the machine what to do. The tape would run and the computer would perform just as the program on the tape directed it to. It's the same deal here. You too can be run by your tapes with no independent mind of your own. Once you finish this section of the audiobook, I think you're very likely to be thinking, "Oh, now I get it. Now I know why I keep winding up where I don't want to be in my life. I was programmed to behave that way and create those results because I was being programmed by powerful thoughts I wasn't even aware of." Now, because tapes are so important, I want to make sure that you're totally clear about what they are. They are as natural and uncontrollable as any reflex and work as independently as your organs. Just as your heart pumps blood and your lungs intake oxygen and release carbon dioxide, tapes run on their own accord and without your conscious awareness. As I suggested earlier, although tapes have some kind of kinship with internal dialogue, tapes belong to a species all their own. Tapes are long-held, overlearned, lightning-fast automatic thoughts that, one, totally ignore current input, and two, program you for a specific outcome, oftentimes without your even being aware of it. Suppose, for example, you meet a guy, and after talking to him for a while, you say to yourself, "This guy is a total mouth breather. He is so boring, I would rather be home in my fuzzy house shoes eating peanut butter out of the jar." What you've just told yourself constitutes internal dialogue. It is a real-time conversation in reaction to current stimuli. It all happens in the here and now. You are there, he is there, and you react to him and what is going on right now. Based on your current reactions, you may decide, "Hey, I'm out of here. Goodbye." A tape is totally based on past experience. It causes you to ignore what is happening in the here and now. For example, if it was your tape that caused you to bail on the doofus you were contemplating killing some time with, that decision would be based on a pre-recorded reflex that occurred independently of anything he did or didn't do. Let's say, for example, that you had dated 7 doofi in a row. The last one was incredibly insufferable, drank all of your wine, ate all of your groceries, and then bedded down your little sister. You would likely have some powerful baggage, particularly when added on top of the other six bad experiences you had been through. Those experiences and the themes they created at the level of your self-concept would be the building blocks of your tapes. You might have a whole library of tapes which might include, men are selfish when it comes to relationships. I pick losers every time, so what's the point? Men always use me, so I must deserve it. If I don't nail them first, they will nail me eventually. Notice that each tape does several things. First, it includes a judgment of yourself or others. Second, it involves a specific context. And third, it predicts an outcome. In these circumstances, I pity the next poor guy who's standing on your porch all dressed up, car washed, and ready to have a good time. That boy is dead in the water before he even opens his mouth. It wouldn't make any difference if he were sweeter than Mr. Rogers or better looking than Tom Cruise. He's toast. Why? Because at the core of your self-concept, you're playing these tapes rather than dealing in the here and now. That's how tapes work, and that's what makes them so dangerous. Here's another example. Suppose that while interviewing for a really good job, one you would love to have, you learn that you're one of the final candidates. A rational conclusion might be, you know, I think I've got a good shot here. I need to stay focused and make this deal happen. But here comes that damn tape. It all started when you got fired from your post as deputy assistant dog catcher 40 years ago. You were really proud of that job, and it hurt and hurt badly when you got fired. It was the first time you ever truly failed at something you cared about, and it changed you in some way. On the basis of that history, your 40-year-old tape may be telling you, you're not bulletproof here. You've been failing since you were a very young kid. Let's face it, here you are, 55 years old, and you're having to start a new job. You're the type that gets fired from jobs. We already know that, right? They're going to see right through you. Your tape then predicts an outcome. Give it up. You'll never get the job. If that tape switches on just as you go into the next interview, you may find yourself doing and saying the kinds of things that sabotage your efforts to make a positive impression. With your speech, posture, gestures, and demeanor, you may emit a persona that says to that interviewer in effect, "Gosh, I can't believe you're actually considering me for this job. You don't really plan to hire me, right?" And the interviewer may be sitting there thinking, "Well, gee, if you've got doubts, and you obviously do, then who am I to argue with you?" Now remember, in contrast to the rest of your internal dialogue, which is reactive to happenings in the here and now, tapes operate in and affect all three tenses of your life, your past, your present, and your future. Here's what I mean. A tape looks backward to your past. It is a backward-oriented thematic reaction to a particular moment or self-observation from your personal history. It is a pre-recorded message with a powerful emotional component. It is an encoded long-term memory that is highly resistant to change. A tape expresses a judgment about who you are in the present. The tape encodes a past perception just below the level of your consciousness, where it plays over and over until it is so overlearned as to be automatic. It is spring-loaded to seize control whenever a relevant situation arises in the present. And lastly, a tape predicts the outcome you will have in the future. Any given tape predicts and therefore controls your thinking and behavior, and thus controls the outcome you will have. You make decisions about the present and predictions about the future based on this historical tape. You may be thinking, "Hey, wait a minute. What about positive tapes? What if my history is positive, so my tapes are programming me to believe I can't miss, that I always come out on top?" Sorry, but if you're thinking that that is a good thing, We have two problems. One, you're wrong. And two, I obviously haven't done a very good job of teaching you about tapes. There is no such thing as a positive tape. Now, you might think, well, how can a tape say positive things and yet be negative? What about the power of positive thinking and all that jazz? Well, think about it in a real-world situation. Suppose you're sitting on an airliner at the end of the runway in January in Alaska. The weather is windy, icy, and snowy, and the pilot has a decision to make. Do we take off or do we not? Now, suppose that instead of evaluating the current conditions, your pilot decides to go because he believes in himself and because every other takeoff he has ever made turned out okay. His tape might be, "Hey, I always come out okay. I always land on my feet." It is a positive content tape in the sense that it has an affirming message, but it is not based on the here and now, and therefore cannot be a plus in any sense of the word. I gotta tell you, anytime I'm on an airliner, I want my pilot looking at the current situation and making a real-time, informed decision, not picking his course of action, and therefore mine, on what happened 1, 2, or 5 years ago. Like any other internal dialogue, your tapes are as unique to you as your DNA. Nevertheless, to stimulate your thoughts about them, you may find it helpful to take a look at a list of common tapes, messages that I'm convinced are playing in some form or fashion in lots of people's heads. Do any of the following 10 tapes sound familiar to you? I will never have a good experience. My family was so dysfunctional, we never learned how to have fun. I'm so ugly, my body and face are so different from those of the popular people that I will have to settle for third class. My future will be like my past, unlucky and non-productive. I should never expect to be successful because it's not my destiny. I have done some bad things, and I will never be forgiven. Guilt is just my cross to bear. People will always disappoint me and hurt me. I was abused as a child. All men will use me for what they want and be insensitive to how I feel. My family was low class. I will be low class. There's nothing I can do to change that. My father was a loser. I will be a loser, regardless of what happens. I'm a leader. People look to me to be strong and set an example. I must never show my weakness. I must be strong, never showing my real self for the rest of my life. Laziness is a sin, so I should never relax. And lastly, I am not worthy of people's respect and consideration. One or more of these tapes, or some version of them, may be at work in your life. I encourage you, as we go forward, to start thinking about what your own collection of tapes might include. To learn still more about the content of your tapes, you need to become familiar with what I call fixed beliefs. Generally speaking, when a tape plays in your head, automatically speeding you toward a particular conclusion and a particular outcome, that tape is taking orders from your most powerful organizational perceptions, the perceptions about how things are supposed to work. These are what I call your fixed beliefs. Fixed beliefs reflect your overall understanding of your place in the world. They are fixed in the sense that you are no longer adding or subtracting new information. They are perceptions that have become rigid and unchanging. Fixed beliefs go with you everywhere you go and are basic to every part of your life. They influence every value you have, your perceptions of your basic worth as a human being, your core traits and characteristics. Fixed beliefs express themselves through concepts like should and must. They are in truth demands, demands for your compliance with a particular vision of what life is, demands for you not to make waves or disrupt the roles that others play. If your beliefs were not fixed, you might well be asking questions and forming new expectations that would disrupt the assigned order of your life. By contrast, these fixed beliefs are there to keep you on task. A fixed belief keeps you within your assigned place in this world. It establishes the boundaries of what you are willing to accept from life. Perhaps the easiest way to get a handle on fixed beliefs is simply to understand that they define the roles you play in life. In other words, once you know what your fixed beliefs are, you know something about the script that is running your life. If you're living by a script, maybe one written by you years earlier, maybe written by someone else, do you even know what it is? Are you living your lines and following your script? Is it what you would write today if you were writing that script all over again? Does your script have you spending your life pursuing what you really want? Or did that get dropped from your script a long time ago? Have you outgrown or just evolved away from the script? As I suggested earlier, the script of life that you are living builds on and draws its strength from certain cornerstones called fixed beliefs. Your fixed beliefs tell you what role you're playing. They have become set in stone, but it is a stone that I intend to chip away. Let's look more at how dependent your script is on fixed beliefs. Fixed beliefs describe the action. They tell you how things are going to turn out. They anesthetize your fear of the unknown by pushing you in the direction of something knowable and familiar, even if not fulfilling. When you start to feel off track or out of control, your fixed beliefs provide a refuge. Like a panicky actor grabbing for his script, you go back to your fixed beliefs. They tell you what to say and do, and you instantly feel comfortable. Equilibrium is restored. Now, here's the key thing for you to understand about fixed beliefs. When you're at the mercy of a fixed belief, in other words, when you're living from a script, you will resist any change to that script. When events go counter to your fixed beliefs, even if you recognize that you've never been happier or more peaceful, a sense of destiny intrudes. You get a queasy feeling, an apprehension that things just aren't right somehow. Your internal dialogue becomes something like, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to be struck down any minute. This is not my destiny. This is not my role." What happens is that you cannot be happy being happy. You will be miserable if your script is to be miserable, because that is your self-ordained destiny. You can be miserable even if you start to be happy, because happiness was not part of your script. Happiness belongs to some other character in the drama, not you. So instead of enjoying the feelings, you fear that something is wrong or that it is only the calm before the storm, since you know the script and happiness is just not part of it. Fear of change, even positive change, is a powerful restraint. The thought of deviating from the narrow path of fixed beliefs and the life script that contains them can be unbearable for some people. In one of the places where I grew up, there was a large empty field behind our house. As a kid of 10 or 11, I used to meet my buddies back there for bicycle races, dirt clod wars, and all sort of mischief. A deep trench ran from one end of field to the other, about 6 feet wide and 4 feet deep. A typical challenge we used to set ourselves was to cross this trench, we called it the Valley of Death, going full speed on our bicycles over a bridge consisting of a single 2x6. What I learned very early was that if I approached the bridge with the thoughts of something disastrous, like sliding off the board or missing it altogether, sure enough, it would happen. If I focused on shooting smoothly to the opposite side, that too would happen. It was as if by summoning the right imagery in my mind, I could direct my muscles and consequently the bicycle to glide over this valley of death. As I approached the board, therefore, I always tried to focus on a single point, the far end of the board. I tried to shut out all other data, believing that it might cause me to topple headfirst into the ditch. Now, focusing on a worthy goal is a good thing. But suppose there had been no ditch, just a plank lying on the ground. When people adopt fixed beliefs, when they become fixed at a certain point in life, it's because they think they have no choice. They are fixated on sticking to the dead center of a narrow board, even when there's no ditch. They are unwilling to deviate from the fixed belief because they think they can't. Even when a smoother, safer, and more enjoyable ride is within easy reach, they will still cling to their scripted route through life, simply because it feels safe. Ask yourself, are you walking an imaginary tightrope when in truth, you could easily step to one side or the other and be just fine? I rode my Valley of Death tightrope as a kid just for fun. If you're doing it in your life, I'm betting it isn't much fun at all. The point is that most fixed beliefs are also limiting beliefs. They impose upon you such powerful restrictions that the possibility of freedom, of being released from the treadmill of routine unhappiness, seems somehow threatening. People script a life with a certain income, certain relationships, and a certain lifestyle. And although we say we want more, we're very uncomfortable about taking any steps toward change. Amazingly, people often opt for a familiar lifestyle that is admittedly unfulfilling rather than an unfamiliar alternative, even though the alternative may be clearly superior. And remember, you are not the only one in your life who may be working from a set of fixed beliefs. Other people may also be working from a script or series of expectations about how you should behave, what you should say, and what you should do. When you make the decision to go off script, they may feel highly threatened and anxious. If someone were to ask you today, what script are you playing in your life? What would you say? Would you say, I'm a mom, I'm a doting parent, a dutiful wife or respected husband, successful professional, the king of money? Or would you identify yourself by your heritage? I'm the daughter of John and Mary Smith. If so, are you following the family script? It's time now to slow your own tapes down to a speed that can be heard and analyzed. You do that by listening consciously and by asking yourself key questions about what you believe at various times in your life. What are the tapes in your life? Be patient with yourself as you stop and listen for your tapes. Stop and take a breath before you make assumptions. Take time to question yourself and write your thoughts down. Doing the following exercises right may require several days of listening, analyzing, and recording. Use your private journal for each of the following exercises. Exercise 1. Assume you're going to meet someone whom you respect tremendously, perhaps a celebrity, a very wealthy and powerful person, or someone whose values and beliefs you hold in high regard. As you consider this hypothetical meeting, I want you to question yourself very carefully. Examine what's going on in your mind. If you know you would be intimidated, then acknowledge that. If you would be scared, anxious, or feeling dumb or undeserving, then admit that to yourself. When you're ready, write down the words that underlie and describe how you would be feeling as you approach this encounter. What you write down will be very important content from your tapes about you, your adequacy, your worth, and your value. Exercise 2. Every day for the next week, when you awaken in the morning, roll over and write down your attitudes and expectancies for the day. Are you optimistic? Are you fearful or anxious? Are you bitter and resentful? Remember, I'm not talking about your real-time internal dialogue, which might actually include a conscious pep talk simultaneous with a much less optimistic tape. You'll recall that tapes predict a specific outcome. So I'm talking about drilling down and asking yourself how you really expect the day to go. Let's take a look at your personal tapes. Looking back over those tapes, do you see any similarities or patterns? Using your journal, Identify whatever common threads or patterns there are. Now let's turn your assessment to your scripts and fixed beliefs. Exercise 1. Take some time to consider all the scripts that you have played in your life. There have probably been many. They might include friend, worker, loving parent, cheerleader, dancer, professor, athlete, spouse, invalid, son or daughter. Remember that a script governs what you say and do. It also imposes expectancies or roles on other people. So when thinking about your script, try first to recall roles you have played that governed your actions and which you felt at the time would directly influence your results. Once again, use your journal. First, simply name the script, identifying it by the role you play. Mother, wife of alcoholic, slut, geek. Then in simple terms, list the activities or behaviors that that script calls for. Your purpose here is simply to call to mind what you actually did as a result of playing the role that was scripted. Next, in a paragraph or two, describe how people responded to you as a consequence of your role. What did this role elicit from the other players in the script? Having done this first exercise for one script, turn to any other scripts that you play and, one by one, write about them using the same instructions. Exercise 2. Now that you've identified some of the scripts you have played, go back and do the following. Circle those roles you felt to be most congruent with what you want your life to be. If you were describing yourself to another person, what scripts would you most be proud to share and want that person to know about you? Which roles did you enjoy playing? Circle them. Similarly, if you were describing yourself to someone else, which roles would you be most ashamed of? Put checks next to those roles that you absolutely hated having to play. And lastly, for every script you've identified, positive or negative, write 2 paragraphs about whoever it was in your life that had the biggest role in imposing that particular script. Then, write 2 paragraphs about why you think that person cast you in that role and what they got out of it. Exercise 3. Using the list of scripts you have made, I now want you to project yourself into each and every script, one at a time, by speaking in character for a few minutes. Speak the words that you would typically say when you are in that particular role and speak them out loud. For example, if you have chosen the script of mother, pretend that you are mothering someone and say what you might say out loud. For example, you might find yourself saying something like, "Now be sure and bundle up because I don't want you to get a cold. Remember, mother loves you and she doesn't want to worry about you." Understand that I'm not saying that this first script that you're examining, or any other script, is inherently good or bad. But every script has feelings attached, and I want you to pay attention to how you feel when you are in that role. So talk long enough that you can identify those feelings and emotions that come to you. The feelings may be positive and calming, or they may be anxiety and anger-provoking. That is what I want you to note. Whichever your experience, the feelings are likely to be significant, and I want you to identify them. Lastly, write in as much detail as possible that life script which you would write for yourself, given an unfettered choice. Do not try to please anyone or even to think about whether it is appropriate or not. Let yourself dream a bit here. What script would you choose if you could do anything you wanted? What emotion would you feel and with whom would you share it? Earlier, I suggested that your life could be thought of as a chain, which is, of course, a series of connected links. You have been working very hard to identify many of those important links. It's now time to bring all your hard work together, assess what it means to you, and make a plan to do something about it. Having grown up around my dad, who worked in the oil patch of Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado, I vividly remember that the first chains I ever saw were those used around drilling rigs. Bulky, greasy, and dark, some of them had individual links you could barely pick up. Working around those chains was a hard, dangerous, and dirty way to make a living. As a kid, whenever I heard stories about prisoners being chained in a dungeon, I always thought of those huge, hideous chains wrapping some poor soul around his neck and his ankles. They represented to me a very confining force. Chains controlled you. They held you back and took away your freedom. I guess that gives you a clue as to how I see your personal life chain. Not a pretty mental image, but a representative one nonetheless. I believe that way too often, what we find ourselves doing in our lives is the product of negative momentum, the product of our life chain linking our past into our present and our future. Your self-concept, whether fictional or authentic, is a product of this linking. That continuity may be positive or it may be negative, but either way, the connection is undeniable. How that chain gets made and evolves into who you become has been the subject of this audiobook. What I'm specifically talking about now is creating or recreating exactly the chain and self-concept you want. Throughout this audiobook, I've tried to get you to look at your past life because I believe that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. That being true, the links in the chain of your history predict your future. For most people, that means if life has been a mess in the past, it will most likely be a mess in the future. That does not have to be true for you. You now have the wherewithal to change your momentum by breaking your chain and starting a new one. At first, perhaps it's just one day of new history, then 1 week, then 1 month, and 1 year. Soon, you have a whole new history predicting a whole new future. As each day of new behavior is stacked up, that new prediction gets stronger and stronger and stronger and more accurate. The challenge then is to break from the old and come in with the new. The reason we have spent so much time on the old was to ensure that you had the blinders off and knew exactly what specific parts of your past were tied to what specific parts of your present. Now you know. Your own external experiences in life and your internal reactions to them have hammered out a self-concept that has defined you throughout your life. Just as surely as a blacksmith hammers out and forges hot metal on an anvil, the shaping of your self-concept has been no different. You have pounded on yourself with your internal perceptions and self-talk, and you have been pounded on and shaped by the behavior and messages of those you have encountered in your life. Your defining moments, critical choices, and pivotal people have been among the hammers that have pounded on the metal of your self-concept. Well, I have a new and bold plan. It's time for you to become the blacksmith of your own life. It's time for you to stop being passively shaped by the internal and external forces in your life. It's time to start moving in a new direction that is grounded in the vibrant here and now instead of continuing in the old direction that is grounded in a tired, outdated, and irrelevant history. To redefine your life and your self-concept, you must do two things. First, you must acquire some very specific tools. Second, you must commit to being totally and courageously honest in evaluating and using all the information you have amassed thus far. Some of that which you have identified has been ugly and unpleasant to acknowledge, and now is the time to do something about it. Insight without action is worse than being totally asleep at the switch. What I'm saying is that if you want to maximize your quality of life and escape from the traps that have contained you thus far, you're going to have to find the courage to continue to be real, and you are going to have to get active in changing your life pattern both internally and externally. No con, no excuses, no blaming others for the choices you've made. You must decide which elements of your self-concept you value and therefore want to keep, and decide which ones you do not. There's a prayer that asks for the wisdom to understand the difference between things that can be changed and things that cannot. I can tell you that as we develop your action plan, the plan to create more of who and what you authentically are, your internal factors will become the central elements of that plan. Here's why. If you know the events that have driven your self-concept, and you can identify the reactions that you've had to those events, then you know what the levers are that you can pull to change it. Those levers are your internal factors. That is not to say that we're going to disregard your outward behavior. There's a raging controversy in psychology about how best to bring about positive changes in people. The controversy boils down to this. Do we change feelings and emotions first and let behavioral change follow? Or do we change behaviors first, hoping that when people do different, they will feel different? I've listened to brainiac academicians go on ad nauseum about who in this debate was right and who was wrong. Meanwhile, the people in need of change sit there thinking, hell, I don't care, just give me a plan. As many a politician has often said, I feel strongly both ways. In short, who cares about how the debate comes out? Why not do both at once? Work on changing how you think and feel while at the same time behaving your way to success. The plan you're about to learn is designed to help you do just that. It will help you make changes internally and change the way you engage the world externally at one and the same time. As you think, feel, and behave differently, you will be observing yourself and creating new, accurate data for your self-concept. As you see yourself behave differently, behave more authentically, behave with more loyalty to yourself, both internally and externally, you will be creating a new history that will predict a new future. As I said earlier, we may not be able to change what has happened in your life, but we can certainly change the messages that have emanated from those events. What this plan challenges you to do is pick up a particular link in your life chain, examine it, test your responses to it, then and now, then question the conclusions you have drawn and the behaviors you've engaged in as a result. I intend to challenge thoughts, feelings, and reactions that you may have been passively accepting for years and years. You may not have known better then, but you will know better now, and you will be amazed at the power you have. So, here's the plan. Step 1. Isolate a target or triggering event. Step 2. Audit your internal responses to that triggering event. Step 3. Test your internal responses for authenticity. Step 4. Come up with an authentically accurate alternative response. Step 5. Identify and execute your minimal effective response, or MER. Those are the key steps of your action plan. Now I'm going to explain how we are going to get specific and put the plan to work for you. As you take up this 5-step plan, let me encourage you to look back at the work you've already done. It's perfectly acceptable, and in fact a good idea, to use your journal as a stimulus or prompt for the upcoming exercises. It may well help to re-examine some of the internal dialogue you recorded. The point is that this 5-step plan is designed to build on and incorporate the foundation you have already laid. You don't need to feel as though you have to build all of this from scratch. If you have faithfully worked through the previous exercises, some of the mechanics of this plan should already look somewhat familiar to you. I hope and trust that the work you've done so far has brought you some much-needed clarity and that you already feel some lightening of your load. What the 5-step plan can do is get you much, much farther down that road. Since I believe it's always helpful to have a model or example to refer to as you apply any plan to your own life, allow me to share with you the story of a former patient of mine. I will tell you up front that today, Rhonda is a happy and productive mother of two college sons. She is happily married and stays busy with a variety of things she enjoys doing. I'm confident she would tell you that she is today living consistently with her authentic self. However, this was far from true just a few years ago. Please understand that in telling you about Rhonda's history, my intention is not to shock you. In fact, your own history may contain elements that are even more tragic than hers. My purpose in sketching in the general outline of Rhonda's story is simply to show you how one person might put the five-step plan to work in her own life. When she first came to my office, Rhonda was in her early 30s. As soon as she started talking, it was clear to me that her authentic self had been all but destroyed. She clearly despised herself and had absolutely no self-confidence or sense of worth. She was lost and lost big time. It did not take long to find the first link in this horrible chain of life. Starting at the tender age of 12, she had been beaten, raped, and sexually exploited by her biological father. The horrors of that treatment unfolded over several sessions that we spent together, with Rhonda initially actually making excuses for her tormentor. Rhonda eventually told me that her father, a regional marketing rep for a major manufacturer, had often required her to go on sales trips with him during her summer vacations, trips that involved driving several hundred miles in order to call on customers in several states. It soon became apparent that her father was a sick drunk with a terrible psychopathic mean streak. Late at night, staggering drunk, after an evening of drinking and partying with customers he was entertaining, he would frequently bring them back to his hotel room where they would gamble, yell and scream, fight, and have sex with the prostitutes or women they had picked up in the bars. On a number of occasions, these drunken slobs would actually force themselves upon Rhonda while her father sat by watching as he drank himself into a mindless stupor. He would zone out, but his anger was never far below the surface. The slightest resistance on her part would provoke both his words and his fist. If she cried out or tried to get away, he would beat her brutally and guilt-induce her by saying, "You selfish little bitch, why are you trying to ruin my business? These men feed you. They keep a roof over our heads. Do you want your mother and your brothers and sisters to starve? You're nothing but a little whore anyway. You crawl in the back seat with your worthless boyfriends while they fill you up. You can damn sure do it with those that put food on our table." Boy, oh boy, did I want to meet this mouth breather. Of course, none of what he told her was true, and Rhonda had certainly never crawled anywhere with anyone before her father had stolen her dignity. This precious child was a virgin before her initial trip with her father that first dark summer. Once this heinous behavior had begun, Rhonda's sense of self-worth, all of her hope, optimism, and esteem was shattered. Through her father's actions, she had been assigned and browbeaten into a role, and with a broken spirit, she accepted that fictional self-concept and the painful life script that came with it. As if to add insult to injury, Rhonda's father had recently passed away. As a result, she was a cauldron of emotions. On the one hand, she was relieved that this evil man no longer walked on this earth. On the other, she felt guilty that she wasn't sorry. Also bubbling around in her emotional pot was a sense of rage and frustration that he had died without ever having been held accountable for his actions. It would be an understatement of unbelievable proportions to say that when she came to me for help, Rhonda had a seriously damaged and distorted concept of self and some major unfinished emotional business. The goal was to get Rhonda back in touch with an authentic self she hadn't experienced since she was a child. I wanted to get her to the point where she could regard herself with respect, dignity, value, and optimism. All of her internal factors, where her real power resided, were way off track. Her internal factors were horribly distorted and working in the